The technology just escapes me sometimes. So welcome.
Oh, I suspect that is not true. Librarians are very, very tech savvy.
Well, just before we started, you were singing the praises of libraries.
Right. So I grew up in the Metro New York area, and my first, well, I babysat maybe twice, realized I hated it, and got a work permit as soon as I turned 15 and got a job as a page at the library in my hometown for the grand rate of, gosh, this was about, would have been in the early 90s, and I think I was making $3.54 an hour. And it was the greatest job. I mean, I even liked shelf reading, which for the uninitiated is quite literally reading the shelves to make sure that things are in the right order so that people can find them. And I worked in libraries through college. And for this book that I wrote, you know, I never would have been able to do it without both the University of Michigan Library, where I was a Knight Wallace Fellow for a year, but also, you know, the Somerville Library, that would be Somerville, pardon me, that's Somerville, Massachusetts, where I used to live, pardon me, the New Orleans Library interlibrary loan service, because you can get anything you want through the library. And then all of the amazing online resources like the HathiTrust Digital Library that has uploaded just enormous quantities of materials from the past.
Sorry, we're having trouble streaming live. And the tech help has just arrived. But you and I are going to keep talking. It's not connected to the...
Okay. Well, I... Yeah.
Okay, sorry. This is live radio.
Oh, it happens.
To me, all the time. So how did you come up with this idea to write this book, or what was the impetus?
So it's a funny story. I was an education reporter at the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and I knew I wanted to write a book. And I was thinking about what I wanted to write the book about. And I wanted it to have to do with education and with history and with race, gender, and class, because I mean, without that, it just felt like it wouldn't be relevant. And then I was thinking, I was talking, in fact, to a woman who was on the board for the Knight Wallace Fellowship. And she said, well, you know, the University of Michigan libraries have this amazing culinary collection. And that got me really excited. And I thought, I would like to use that collection in some way. And just, you know, more generally speaking, like, I love to cook. I knit. I crochet. Like, this book should probably have some connection to my hobbies, because I hear books are a lot of work, which, in fact, they are. So I put all of that in my head, and I just, you know, thought about it for a few weeks, and suddenly one day I thought, oh, home economics. Like the class that taught girls how to cook, because that's what I thought it was at the time. And I soon, you know, even at that moment, I thought, geez, why isn't home ec back? Like, shouldn't we be in the middle of like a home ec revival in schools, right? With people so excited. I mean, we have HGTV, we have the Food Network, we have, you know, the knitting revival and DIY everything and fears about adulting and even a revival of career technical education. Why? And I had not heard a word about home economics in the 4 or 5 years I had been covering education at that point. And so already I thought it was a great idea, but then I started doing some research into the subject, and I learned that the first woman, one of the founders of home economics, was the first woman to go to MIT. And that immediately just blew my mind about, like, what I was looking at. It became obvious that, you know, there must be something, there must be so much more here than we know if one of the founders of home economics was a pioneering scientist. And that, in fact, turned out to be the case. There's a lot more there that, you know, I certainly, most people don't know at all.
And Ellen Richards was that woman, correct?
Right, right.
And in your preface, first of all, I encourage everybody to get a copy of Danielle's book. We have it at the library. But if, you know, read the preface at least, and read the conclusion, because perfectly encapsulates the rest of the book. And once you read the preface, you're going to want to read. But I love the sentence, in its purest form, home economics was about changing the world through the household.
Yes.
And I sort of feel like this past year that has happened. Wouldn't you, like, with more people home and households changing and the just everything changing? Yes.
Yeah, I really think that, you know, it's unexpectedly fortuitous timing for the book to come out. And I mean, I finished the book at the end of June, early July of last year. So I wrote a bunch of, we might be getting apparently some technical fuzz, by the way, from chords. So, I finished the book during lockdowns and, you know, surrounded by the things of the home. I don't know, by the way, how I would have finished the book if I had kids, because that was one of the things I recognized immediately, right? It was, here we are doing so many more things around the home. And the pandemic has really highlighted the necessity and the undervaluation of household labor that home economists were so aware of all the way along, right? Because you have all these companies just telling their employees to work from home and assuming that they could do that while there was no school, right? Like assuming, like, as if children don't need to be watched and taken care of and helped with virtual school. And, you know, as if none of these tasks, like, it truly is invisible labor. And it really made me think so much more about the relevance of what home economists had said and taught about the value, the economic value of the home.
And so even the first woman at MIT at the beginning of the 20th century, but this goes back even to the 19th century with Catherine Beecher. And Harriet Beecher Stowe's sister, and she wrote a book, the treatise,
treatise on domestic economy.
Thank you. I was going to say home economics, and I knew that wasn't right. And this is what interests me. I am a huge Little House on the Prairie fan. The books.
Oh gosh, me too.
Not so much the TV show, and just. When you think about that, these women were sewing their clothes by hand, stitching them, and they had to know how to be doctors and nurses and caregivers and a little bit of everything. And a few years ago, or quite a few years ago now, HarperCollins started publishing a second series, a series of books about Ma growing up, Caroline, the Caroline years. And she went to Milwaukee one year in this book, attended a girls' college, and... the book they taught was Catherine Beecher.
Milwaukee, huh?
It was
interesting.
Yeah, it was, and I don't know how much of it is based in reality, but I was fascinated that somebody had taken the time to write all this down that far ago, that long ago.
Yeah. That's especially interesting because so Catherine Beecher wrote this book in 1841, and this was a time when almost no girls went to school. Like, she herself founded two of the earliest schools for girls, the earliest high schools for girls, or secondary schools, I suppose.
I guess that the women kept everything in their heads and passed it down generation to generation, or would write down in ledgers or... pass receipts, stat receipt books, recipe books.
I think it's really interesting to, and this is one of the first things I highlight in the book, is Catherine Beecher. So if Catherine Beecher was quite a piece of work. She was a really, I mean, I don't, everybody, all the women I write about in this book are just so smart and so motivated, and they had to be. You know, they were growing up in times of far fewer opportunities. Even the white women had far fewer opportunities. And Catherine Beecher, you know, wrote this book in which she argued that the home, basically she began professionalizing the work of the home. And she said that, you know, the home, it was all too important to be left to amateurs, that would be mothers. And she, her own schools taught, you know, the science of the day, and, you know, they were elite educational institutions, but she was also thinking about what are more practical things for girls in particular to learn. And Catherine Beecher was, you know, the foremother of the home economics movement, though, you know, she definitely believed and reinforced the idea that, you know, women's place was in the home. She just tried to make that place like a, she has this amazing, like, feat of rhetoric where she then, like, turns it around and says it's the most important part of society because it's where we shape our future citizens. And the later home economists didn't really, you know, deal with that as much, but she was, I mean, she herself, like, foreshadowing many later home economists, she never got married. She never had children. You know, she was talking about raising children and take, and I mean, she certainly helped take care of people's homes, but, like, she lived with her siblings. She lived with her father. She lived at times with former students. You know, she was not, she most emphatically did not lead a life that was, like, in the women's sphere of the home.
Right. So I want to kind of fast forward ahead
right
to the 20th century. That's a rabbit hole I just went down. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I do that. I do that a lot.
Oh, this was one of those things where, like, I did so much work for this book, research that I couldn't get into. Like, all of the Catherine Beecher research I did, and I'm like, okay, I guess I have 3 pages.
Yeah, no, I was just like, oh, I've heard of her. I know about this. Mm-hmm. So home economics as a science probably came into its own beginning of the 20th century. Is it fair to say?
Yeah. So to move forward, the key things that the founders of home economics did, the movement started really taking off post-Civil War when there was this explosion in the number of colleges, and there were colleges not just for the elite, but for farmers and people of color and women, and they were thinking about what to teach. And many of them wanted to teach these more practical vocational subjects along with academics. And then a group of home economists, well, they began calling themselves home economists at this meeting, got together in 1899 at Lake Placid, New York, a meeting helmed by Melville and Annie Dewey, Melville of the Dewey Decimal System. And they codified this field. And what the field became over the next few decades was they were doing two things. So they were bringing science into the home to make taking care of the home faster, more efficient, less physically agonizing, focused on sanitation and the things that really matter and not the things that don't, so that women or whoever was taking care of the house, but it was usually women, would have more time to do other things, whether that be working for pay or studying or taking care of their children or, you know, anything they wanted to do, participating in the public sphere. And simultaneously, they took the home and turned it into this array of careers in science, in business, in education, in hotel management, in textiles. And all of these were jobs where women were accepted because it was seen as, it was like connected to women's traditional work. And there was always a tension in the field as to whether they were liberating women as they thought or whether this was repressive. Like, are they branching out or are they sort of keeping themselves painted into a corner? And they partnered up with many generally white men over the years who were perfectly happy to have, you know, teach this stuff because they thought it was, you know, women staying in the home while the home economists were using this to have careers. And, you know, in the end, after World War II, this relationship kind of turned around to bite them in the rear. But for, you know, a number of decades, it was really just, you know, it provided an extraordinary array of opportunities for women.
And it spawned a whole bunch of industries, like Betty Crocker. Eventually, the women, the home economists, and I'm calling them women because I would say for the most part.
They mostly were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frozen food and convenience food. And a stereotype I would think would be that you would traditionally want like home-cooked meals and then set the table and put flowers on the table. But they were also about the economy part, the economy of time.
Right. The Bureau of Home Economics, which existed starting in the 1920s, did time studies of how women from an array of backgrounds actually spent their time. They argued for the economic value of the labor of the home, which is something that, you know, feminist economics proper, like, didn't get around to for years. I mean, feminist economics didn't exist for years. And they were very, I mean, they did... They created, among other things, the kitchen layout that most of us have today, which is called, like, the at that time they called it the practical layout. It's been called the L-shaped layout. And it was designed to minimize steps, which, I mean, nowadays everyone's, you know, putting on pedometers and trying to maximize their steps. But at the time, you know, before the labor-saving devices, taking care of a house was extraordinarily physical, and it just broke people down.
And then these women also came up with things like the seven food groups.
Yeah, so they've ranged, by the way, from 7 to 5 and in between since then.
The clothing care labels, school lunches, right. School lunch programs. And Michelle Obama was a big proponent of a lot of, it could be an extension of like the school gardens and things. But those
right.
were not.
Right, home economists were talking about school gardens in 1900.
Right, they were not new initiatives. Do you think during World War II, home economics particularly took off with Victory Gardens? The women had to contrive to have enough food. Jennifer Ryan just wrote a novel about women in England coming up with. They were having it was a contest. To be a pronouncer on a baking show, on a cooking show. But it was really like, I have sugar rations, but I don't have flour. I need, and just how they contrived different things or negotiated with each other. So I feel like it really thrived then during that time on a more grassroots level.
Yeah, it did. And that was actually something that got started in World War One. I mean, World War One is when home economists really, that was like the big coming out party for home economics, because the Herbert Hoover, who ran the U.S. Food Administration during World War One, knew about home economics, and he called upon home economists to come help him because there was voluntary rationing during World War One, and like they were really emphasizing, yeah, exactly, like the need for people to cut back on sugar, cut back on wheat flour for the, you know, so the boys at the front could have it, contribute wool sweaters to the cause, things like that. And by World War Two, and they were, home economists also played a large role in, you know, similar ways during the Great Depression. And then during World War Two, I mean, from the federal government brought home economists in from the start to help keep people fed and like reasonably satisfied during a time of deprivation. I was just looking last night. I found a press release from January of 1942 that advertised that all of these home economists were from food companies were coming to D.C. to rewrite the Army's cookbook. And, you know, that would be the cookbook that the Army used to feed soldiers. And yeah, this, the War Department put out a whole press release about it.
Oh, wow. I think a lot to think about. I do. Yeah. I do think a lot. So in the 60s and 70s, maybe, the terms changed to family consumer science. And then at one time, even... I've heard it referred to as domestic arts. Is there a difference between the, or it's just trying to glamorize it and make it seem?
Yeah, I mean, the nomenclature has changed many times. Domestic economy was the first name, domestic science, back in the 19th century. The people who gathered for the Lake Placid Conference called it, you know, home economics because they thought that was a more elevated name that sounded more appropriate for a university course because they wanted to get to create university departments, which they did. And then, you know, many years later in after World War II, the cachet of home economics, you know, began to dim. And people began to see it as, like, the big stereotype is just stitching and stirring. And so from the late 60s, colleges began to rename their departments. And sometimes that really did result in a change in what they were teaching or a change in the kind of majors that they had. And they would call themselves the, like, Cornell changed the name to Human Ecology, which, I mean, I grew up in New York State and I was told, like, oh, you could go to the college, you know, there's two colleges at Cornell that have state school prices, and one of them is the College of Human Ecology. And I remember thinking, like, what the heck is that? And they called it, some college departments, Human Development or Human Sciences, something like that. But then the field, more generally speaking, in the 90s, rebranded as Family and Consumer Sciences. And, you know, that was an effort to gain respect and to just, because they just had not succeeded in convincing people that their work was valuable and intelligent and, you know, worthwhile. But, you know, that name has only partially caught on. So there are certainly high school and middle school classes called Family and Consumer Sciences, might be called FACS or FCS. But sometimes it's, you know, life skills or life and career, things like that. And, I mean, certainly I expect any minute now somebody to name a class adulting. But you know, the name of the class doesn't actually have any correspondence to what's being taught in it. Which is one of the reasons that I think, and I say in the book that, yeah, after talking to a whole lot of people on this topic, that we should just go back to the term home economics. Because even, you know, what happened instead of gaining respect, the field lost visibility. At last count, there were still more than 3 million U.S. middle and high school students in public schools taking home economics every year, to say nothing of people studying it in universities, to say nothing of people taking it abroad in other countries where it's often more established. But people don't know that because it's not called home economics anymore.
I feel, reading the book, I got the impression that home economics was the original STEM.
That is certainly, yeah, that is what a bunch of people have told me, is that it was the original STEM.
But you're not buying it, or?
Oh, yeah, I would say there's lots of things that are the original STEM.
Okay. Because we have a sewing machine at the library now. We don't cook because you can't make things and eat them, and we have health department rules. But, you know, we have a sewing machine and we sew and, mm-hmm. So I don't know. And 4-H has always been, to me, a repository of the home economics skills.
Yeah. And 4-H, I mean, 4-H has family and consumer science specialists in it, home economics specialists, and it comes, you know, straight out of the schools of agriculture and the land-grant college movement of the 19th century, which has been a home for home economics for, you know, the whole time. So, yeah, when you go to 4-H and you have people doing, you know, sewing projects as well as, you know, animal feeding projects, like, that is all part of the same package.
Which is kind of interesting, because when I was in 4-H, we had an ag agent and we had a home ec agent.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Okay, and they were separated, and I thought, but, you know, Ma was out feeding the cows, so why are they separate?
I mean,
practical.
Yeah, that, well, no, it's just, it's an artifact of the gendered way that this all went down.
Yeah. So home economics is traditionally a female role, a female field. Did they ever make any attempt to draw men in, or did they want to keep it for themselves?
So they definitely made many efforts to attract men. So a few points about this. One is that until post-World War II, I didn't find a lot, like, there wasn't a heavy hand with gender in the material being produced by home economists themselves. Like, every so often, there would be somebody who came to one of their conferences and talked about how, like, this was the domain of women. But that was not at all the, you know, norm. It was like, these are tasks and we are empowering women because women are the ones who do these tasks and women are the ones, you know, who need more job opportunities. But then, and then after World War II is when there starts to be a lot more emphasis on, like, this is what girls do. And most of that material was written by men or by researchers following men from the new, you know, burgeoning field of child development and child psychology. But, you know, all along, home economists were trying to reach boys. You have, like, articles and projects, like, trying to get boys to take the class. You had, you know, articles that I read an article from the 30s that pointed out, like, what do boys learn to do at West Point? They learn to, like, make their beds and take care of their barracks and take care of their uniforms and cook. Like, there's nothing girly, you know, inherently girly about this. But, you know, the tide did not even begin to turn until the 70s, with Title IX, actually. The law that brought us women's basketball also said in the regulations, like, spells out that it is illegal to put girls in home ec and boys in shop and to just gender segregate those classes. And home economists also believe that girls should take shop. But even so, I mean, as, you know, we live in this culture that is steeped with this idea that this is women's work. And it's hard to go against that. It's hard, you know, even though, I mean, the organization then known as Future Homemakers of America had its first male president in the 80s, who was written about, excuse me, in Esquire magazine. And today, the organization, which is now SCCLA, is about one quarter male, the last I checked. You know, it's like a noticeable minority. And when I talked to middle school boys taking home economics in Virginia, you know, I said to them, like, hey, you know, this used to be considered something that only girls did. And they were just flabbergasted. They're like, that's stupid. Everybody needs to know how to do this stuff. So, I mean, I think that this is, you know, and this is one of the reasons that I suggest one of the values of making home economics mandatory again for, you know, all genders, which is what they do in Japan, for that matter, is just that we are so in this groove of women doing more of the housework than men, and people raise boys differently, usually even if they try not to, right? If they don't mean to. And it's just hard for, you know, a boy to sign up. It's still, I think, harder for a boy to sign up for home economics. So these are skills that everybody needs. So I spoke to the well-known feminist intellectual and writer and activist Robin Morgan, who came to the American Home Economics Association in 1971 and had this remarkable speech where she told them to quit their jobs because they were tools of the patriarchy, thus sparking a necessary and very dramatic bout of soul-searching and, like, feminist revolution among the home economists. And I interviewed her for the book in 2018, and she was like, home economics should exist, and it should be valued. She said, and it should be for boys only.
I smiled when you said her name because my favorite picture in the book is of Robin Morgan. I owe her great debt of thanks. She was protesting women not being allowed in McSorley's Ale House in Greenwich Village in New York City. And I still remember my first trip to McSorley's.
Oh, wow.
So I do owe her a debt of gratitude. But, I mean, there's a lot of great pictures in the in the book, and it just expands beyond just home economics. The picture of the Japanese women in the internment camps learning home economics, because I think the U.S. internment camps are not. I don't think enough is known about them, or taught about them, unless you're specifically interested in that, and. I felt like, unless it was a publicity photo, that an effort was being made to make good use of their time.
Yeah, I don't know this. I don't know the what's the word I'm looking for? Not surroundings. I don't know the circumstances of that photo. Certainly, everybody is very nicely dressed. It struck me as fascinating. So one of the pieces of the home economics story that I tell is that, you know, women of color were simultaneously foundational to and excluded from home economics. Black colleges taught home economics before any other colleges. And I write about, you know, a long lineage of Black women and women of color who were home economists and, you know, were using it to empower their communities. But it simultaneously, you know, along with being excluded from the American Home Economics Association for many decades, home ec was used by there was a strong strain of anti-immigrant and racist sentiments running through the field, sometimes by, you know, professional home economists, sometimes by home ec teachers, professionals and, like, I guess I mean the leaders of the field, and sometimes by, you know, the K-12 school systems. So home ec was seen in the 1910s, especially in 1920s, as this tool to Americanize, quote-unquote, immigrants, and as the perfect education for also to Americanize Native Americans, and then to teach to Black women and Latinas, because they were like, oh, they're just going to be maids anyway, and this is we don't need to teach them chemistry, we don't need to teach them calculus. So I don't know the full story of the education that was being offered in the internment camps, but it just struck me as, like, this was yet another example. Like, there was a bunch of things that the government was doing at the time to try to impose Anglo middle class, like, stereotyped American values on people from all different races and from all different ethnic backgrounds. So, you know, people who were, you know, they were trying to, like, there were bride schools in Japan before World War II for picture brides, and after World War II for American servicemen's wives, to teach them how to keep a proper American home, with the assumption being that, you know, you're going to have to cook hamburgers. You're not going to be able to cook, you know, what you cooked growing up yourself.
Which is kind of interesting because you pointed out earlier that in Japan, everyone takes home economics in school. And
yes, yeah, yeah.
So, I know we're running kind of long. I'm sorry. I go down so many rabbit holes.
Can talk about this book forever. So,
what surprised you the most, and what didn't make it in the book that you think?
Ah, man. I think what didn't make it in the book was mostly, like I said about Catherine Beecher, right? I had to boil things down to one sentence that, you know, people have written entire books about. But I did try to squeeze more in. You know, well, who didn't? Some of the stuff that didn't make it in were things that just were just too tangential. Like, I very briefly mentioned a Canadian home economist named I don't know if it's Alice Chown or Alice Chone. I think it's Alice Chown, who was briefly involved in home economics, but mostly went on to just be like a radical of all sorts. She was a socialist. Technically she believed in free love, but which is to say she never married, and she thought that, like, people should be able to do what they wanted with their relationships. She was a pacifist. She wrote, you know, letters protesting nuclear proliferation. She was a journalist who wrote about sex workers. And, you know, she just went on to lead this extraordinary life. And she published this amazing memoir called The Stairway in the 1920s that, like, talks about her. It starts with, like, her saying, like, I'm 40 years old, but my life has just begun because my mother has died. So she was this, like, astonishing, like, feminist, progressive person about whom so little is known. And I would have had to have, like, I mean, I don't even know how I could have found out more about her. And so her life is fascinating, but it just diverged too much from the actual subject of the book.
So is there anything else that you'd like the viewers?
We should talk about the Deweys. Liz.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Talking a little bit earlier, because this is a library podcast, and the Deweys are really a fascinating. And
oh, I was kind of horrified, actually.
Oh, totally horrifying.
Read it.
So the short version of this, so that Annie Dewey was behind the scenes as she was a librarian. She went to college, married Melville Dewey, who, you know, was dean of the Columbia Library School, pushed for women to be admitted to the Columbia Library School, then became state librarian of New York. He was also just horrible, and she wasn't all that much better. And if ever, you know, it was a fascinating and troubling example of the, you know, partnerships that home economists were willing to make to get their cause out there, because he was this really influential guy. And she was, and Annie was too. They had this resort up in Lake Placid, New York, which, I mean, they had a hotel. Like, they had a big hotel. And Annie got involved in home economics because she was doing housekeeping. She was, you know, running the hotel. She became a hotel manager. And they were both, I mean, so Melville Dewey had his name stripped off one of the American Library Association's awards a few years ago. If ever anybody deserved to be canceled, like, holy moly, Melville Dewey is that person. And he was. So back in 1905, which was in the middle of this 10 years of these Lake Placid home economics conferences, he was forced to resign. I can't remember if he was fired or forced to resign from his library job, and he was booted from the American Library Association, which he had, you know, helped found, because his resort was segregated. He wouldn't let African Americans there, and he wouldn't allow Jews. And he, like, made all sorts of, like, some of my best friends are Jewish. Like, he really actually did write that some of his best friends were Jewish. But simultaneously was buying up land around the resort to keep Jewish people from buying it. And when Booker T. Washington, whose wife was a home ec pioneer, I write about, when Booker T. Washington came to his Lake Placid resort, on Melville's invitation, he made him eat in his own, like, suite and not the dining room, because he was like, oh, the Southern members wouldn't be okay with a black man in the dining room. He was booted from the American Library Association for sexual harassment. You gotta be a pretty bad sexual harasser to get in trouble for it in 1905. And then Annie and Melville went on to embrace eugenics. Annie was a big proponent of eugenics. She went and spoke at the Battle Creek conference on race betterment. And, you know, the home economists just let this stuff slide. I mean, the Deweys sort of fell away from their prominence in the field after a few years, claiming it was because they had just put so much work in and they couldn't afford it any longer. But, you know, I found correspondence between Ellen Richards and Annie Dewey around this time, and Ellen just kind of doesn't talk about it. She does say, like, you know, we don't need to have the conference at Lake Placid. You guys could, like, go away for a summer. Maybe you should go to Europe. Maybe you should take a break. But, you know, they went and had the next conference at Lake Placid as usual. So, yeah, really, really problematic people.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to the library and campaign. We switched to Library of Congress instead of the
Doing. Yeah.
I'm surprised the name has never changed. Well, I'm not surprised, but that the moniker Dewey Decimal System has not.
Yeah. Well, you know, like many things, this stuff was all forgotten about, shoved under the rug, you know, considered unimportant for many, many years. And it's only, you know, in recent times that librarians have dug up all of this, you know, totally out in the open information about Dewey to say, hey, this guy was awful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, your book will be assigned a Dewey Decimal Number, I'm afraid.
It has been. Well, you know, it's funny because there's a wonderful article in some library research journal that points out that the field at Lake Placid talked about what their Dewey Decimal Number should be, because that was, like, significant. And they wanted it to be the number that had been assigned to poverty, because they thought that home economics would erase poverty.
Hmm. Interesting.
Optimistic.
Yeah. Very much so. There's a terrific article in the current, I guess it's still the current issue of New Yorker, April 26th through May 3rd, about your book that everybody should read. We have, through Overdrive, we have downloadable magazines, so you can read it online. Our magazines aren't quite out yet in the public. A couple more weeks. So is there anything else that you want people to know, before they come in and check out your book?
No, thank you. This is wonderful. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah, there were a lot of fascinating rabbit holes to go down.
Yes, many.
So, I can't wait to see what's next, because you put so much in there, but it does not feel overstuffed.
Thank you.
It feels like there's a lot of different little tidbits and, what else could I find out about? So I really appreciate you taking the time this morning, Danielle, and I hope everyone reads The Secret History of Home Economics. I'm not holding up my book because I have an advanced copy with the older cover. I don't have the current cover.
Yeah.
How Trailblazing Women Harnessed the Power of Home and Changed the Way We Live. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
You have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was an interview with Danielle Drehlinger, the author of The Secret History of Home Economics. And this is Hunterdon Chamber Radio still. I'm going to do a quick break, and I will be right back to catch up on some more of what's going on at the library.
You're listening to HunterdonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located at the historic Large House, 119 Main Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programs.
Welcome back to At the Library. Jim Gano will be in at 1 o'clock with his show, Taking Care of Business. So I have a little bit of library business left to wrap up. April was Poetry Month, and we had the second annual HCL Poetry Contest winners announced. Adults, first place was awarded to Diane Clark. Second place, Kathleen Von W. Kevin Zalewski got third place, and Norma Klein received our first ever People's Choice Award. Honorable mention went to Amy H. And then students, first place in the 10 and under went to N. Carl Rush, with second place going to Addison Simony. And the over 11 and over winner is TK. And you can go to our Facebook page to read all the winning poems. They are posted on there. And all the winners received a gift card from City Spot Tea and Coffee in Clinton. And Mark donated gift cards, and he is a constant supporter of the library. And thanks to our adult services librarians, Mary, Terry, and Jane, for judging the adult poetry, and Amy for judging the under 18 categories. Next, 2 weeks from today, May 20th, from 6 to 8 p.m., there's going to be a virtual theater workshop presented by the Cincinnati-based theater educator Aaron Carr. Teens will create original scenes based on familiar book series and develop their own versions of beloved fictional characters. They will go through improvisational exercises that provide tools for creating original work as an ensemble. By acting out scenes from Harry Potter and the Cursed Child and Peter and the Starcatcher, they will learn the framework used for adaptations and take this to create their own scenes using newly gained playwriting and performance skills. And registration is required. There is a link, and it's also on our Facebook page. And this is made possible by a grant from the Huntington County Cultural and Heritage Commission in partnership with the New Jersey State Council on the Arts, and it's an offshoot of the Teen Arts Festival that has been so popular at high schools over the years. Let's see, we had a staff pick on our Facebook page. These are hand-picked titles, hand-picked by HCL staff members. And this month, this week's is Women of Silk and the Language of Threads. In the Women of Silk, Gail Tashikama takes her readers back to rural China in 1926, where a group of women forge a sisterhood amidst the reeling machines that reverberate and clamor in a vast silk factory from dawn to dusk. The simple, elegant, fluid prose weaves a vivid picture of rural China. Her writing is richly descriptive and filled with historical detail, and her characters are fleshed out. And those books are recommended by Carrie. For tweens, grades 3 to 5, we have grab-and-go pipe cleaner crafts. They will be available for pickup on May 21st, 24th, 25th, and 26th, but you need to sign up using the event calendar at hclibrary.us. Make 3 pipe cleaner crafts using the materials in your craft kit. There will be 2 flowers, a bird pencil top, and 1 additional craft, and they can be picked up at the Headquarters North County and South County Branch Libraries. And currently at the Headquarters North County and South County Branch Libraries, we have grab-and-go crafts for adults. They're Mother's Day cards, so pick one up. You still have time to take one home and make it. This afternoon at 1 p.m., is the English Conversation Group on Zoom. If you're studying English as a second language, consider signing up and logging in. You can practice your speaking and listening skills in an informal atmosphere. So this and all our programs can be found at hclibrary.us. Just click on the events calendar and be sure to sign up. And all of our programs are on our homepage. We have some spring STEM projects, Make Blooming Flowers, that will bloom right before your eyes to reveal a surprise, and a parachute toy. We provide you with a variety of materials to design your parachute your way. Will it drift slowly to the ground? Experiment with a design that works for you. And this is for grades K through 2. Again, register on our events calendar. And you will get to pick up May 17th to the 19th. And we also have some coding classes coming up for children. There is a Scratch workshop on Saturdays, May 22nd through June 19th from 10 to 10:45, a weekly workshop for ages 7 to 9. You're invited to join a virtual Scratch coding class presented by AI Go Learning. They provide free coding classes taught by high school and college student volunteers. Their STEM for All initiative promotes coding for communities nationwide. Participants will learn introductory Scratch and make fun projects over the 5 weeks in this class. No prior coding is experience is required. And again, register online at hclibrary.us. The Song of Spring, Listen, Take, and Make programs for children 2 and up is up. There will be a video of Miss Kathy doing a story time on our YouTube channel, and the craft will be at the headquarters, North County or South County branch library to pick up. If you prefer curbside, contact your library and we will set it up at your location choice and share your creations by tagging Instagram at HCL Youth. So all these and more can be found on our website, hclibrary.us, our Facebook page, and our Instagram page. So again, thank you to Danielle Dreilinger for spending some time with us talking about her book, The Secret History of Home Economics, which is available at the Hunterdon County Library. Thank you for listening, and remember, wherever you are, you can stop in, go online, or come in. Your library is always there for you.
USA Radio News with Lance Pry.
Putting more insight into President Trump's Facebook ban being upheld Wednesday morning, former Facebook executive Chris Kelly tells Fox News, although the rules are behind the veil of secrecy, the ultimate goal is transparency.
I think the setting up of the oversight board is designed to address some of those problems. And this isn't the first ruling that they've delivered, but it's obviously the most prominent. And I think the process from here hopefully will demonstrate for the company and for everyone else that they're open to review of a number of these decisions and to more transparency.
Over 12 years, Trump tweeted around 57,000 times, including more than 25,000 times during his presidency. The White House said on Wednesday that the United States Justice Department is reviewing a federal judge's decision to strike down a CDC mandate on the eviction moratorium. Two other federal courts have upheld the moratorium, adding to the confusion about its fate. USA Radio News.
Who's really running the country? Joe Biden? The First Lady? Kamala Harris? Maybe Barack Obama? Already, Kamala Harris is the most powerful vice president in history. All this week, Newsmax's Greg Kelly asked the tough questions about Joe Biden and who's really in charge at the White House. Every night this week, Greg Kelly is on Newsmax giving you the news you need to know. So watch Greg Kelly tonight at 7 p.m. and 11 p.m. Eastern and see his series, Who's Really in Charge? Newsmax TV is America's fourth highest-rated cable news network. Everyone is talking about Newsmax. Find Newsmax on all major cable systems. If you don't get it, call your cable system, tell them you want it. Or get Newsmax free on your smart TV. Or tune into Roku, Amazon Fire, Pluto, Zumo, or YouTube. Or just download the free Newsmax TV app on your smartphone and watch us anytime, anywhere. Millions of Americans are watching Newsmax. So should you.
A maritime standoff between British and France is unfolding as Navy ships from the two countries converge in the waters off the coast island of Jersey, where dozens of French fishermen's boats threaten to block a port. It all started when England left the European Union. Prime Minister Boris Johnson dispatched two British Navy ships as a precautionary measure. On Thursday, France deployed two naval patrol vessels near Jersey, about 14 miles off the French coast in the English Channel, to ensure safety of navigation as well as the safeguard of human life at sea. Fishing was one of the sorest subjects when Britain negotiated its new trade deal with the European Union, which went into effect in January. COVID-19 infections in India hit another grim daily record on Thursday as demand for medical oxygen jumped sevenfold and the government denied reports that it was slow in distributing life-saving supplies from abroad. The health minister also reported just under 4,000 deaths in the past 24 hours, bringing the total to just over 230,000 nationwide. USA Radio News.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
Florida has been one of the top states in the nation with its response to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is giving first responders a $1,000 bonus. Governor DeSantis on Wednesday.
How police were treated last year in many parts of the country was a total disgrace. And they had to put the uniform on. Yes, they knew that the state of Florida had their back, and I think we did much better in Florida. But if you look at what a lot of these police officers are dealing with now, it's terrible. So I thought it was important to recognize the service, to recognize the sacrifice. And I asked the legislature in this legislative session, we need to do bonuses for law enforcement. Some wanted to fund. Some wanted to fund the police. We're funding the police and then some, and that's what we're here today to say. And so thanks to the great work of our legislators who are here with us, as well as the Speaker of the House, Chris Sprouls, the Senate President, Wilton Simpson, we asked and they delivered.
The bill should be on the governor's desk in the next few days. With the chance the National Football League quarterback Aaron Rodgers could be leaving the Green Bay Packers, Mr. Brew's Tap House in Green Bay says it will provide Rodgers and his fiance with free food and beer for life if Rodgers finishes his career as a Packer. USA Radio News, I'm Lance Pryor.